My name is Glenn Gersmill, and the title of the session is Resistance and Hope from Barman to Bonhoeffer. And a subtitle might be Lessons of the Confessing Church in Nazi Germany. Just to be more efficient, I've made up a couple sheets that one called Barman to Bonhoeffer, the setting, that will hopefully allow us to be a little more efficient if there's anyone that doesn't know or wants to be reminded of the sort of background of the rise of Hitler. There's some statistics on the first page, and then on the second side, most of the page looks at what was happening in the Protestant churches in the at the turn of the century up to the period we're dealing with here, and what was the first major clash between the German Christians, those that supported Hitler, and the emerging confessing church. And then finally, just a few statistics about where it led in terms of the war. And I've also put on a board a brief chronology of, in three columns, one on the Christian church, one on the Nazi development, and then thirdly on Bonhoeffer. And for me, the sort of overriding question or interest, I found lots of interests along the way, but the overriding one is just, what does it have to say to us? I mean, it's one of the questions that historians, I think, are very interested in. There are many, many differences between Germany in the 30s and the United States in the 90s. There are also some rather unsettling parallels. The rise of far-right movements and the rise of rhetoric in the public arena criticizing other ethnic groups, the passage of laws in California and elsewhere against immigrants, legal immigrants even. Those people like Walter Wink in Engaging the Powers that are looking at the notion of principalities and powers, and the United States is by no means playing only a benign role in the world, although it's not only playing other than benign roles, and so forth. We could probably come up with others. What I would like to do is just take a minute or two to kind of get on the same wavelength of what was happening in Germany at the time. I'll kind of do an even briefer summary of the setting of Weimar Germany. That the Versailles Treaty was very punitive toward Germany, and Bonhoeffer himself, for example, one of the things that made him the angriest were people to say anything that reminded him or reminded the conversation of the notion that Germany was the only responsible party, you know, for World War I. The result of that, of those reparations and the other treaty kind of activities, was tremendous amount of unemployment, economic problems, political turmoil, tremendous inflation. Your paycheck could be worthless overnight. It could buy something one day and the next day be worthless. Tremendous amount of political instability. 21 different coalitions were in power in Weimar Germany in its short reign. And the result was bitterness, fear for the future, nostalgia for earlier, seemingly simpler days, sense of futility and alienation among younger people. Most of the ruling coalitions were led by very old people. Hindenburg, when Hitler came to power, for example, I think was 81, and they were really out of touch with the youth, who were looking, much like the youth of today, at a future for which they had very little hope and were very ripe for brown shirt kind of activity. The Nazi Party, contrary to some of my stereotypes in along, you know, over my life, was really not only a minority party, but almost a splinter party for all of its life up until Hitler came to power in 1933, had under 20% of the electoral votes all the way to 1933, its membership under a million up until January of 1933, And it was really trickery that brought Hitler into power. I mean, he formed common cause with a fellow who he shared almost nothing politically, and allowed this other person to have the majority of the seats in the cabinet in exchange for Hitler being chancellor. And there's a story of Himmler and some of the other top leaders in a hotel across the street from the from where Hindenburg was making his decision, who looked through binoculars and tried to read the expressions on people's faces to find out even how it turned out. And when they saw Hitler's face, they knew that he had succeeded in this idea. Hitler had pulled strings all around. He'd figured out like who he knew that knew Hindenburg and so forth, and got into power with this just a fragile finger hold almost. I mean, it's a little more than that, of a grasp of power, and then worked very quickly to consolidate that power. And by March 23, 2 months later, 2.5 months later, had passed this enabling act by throwing a bunch of his adversaries in the Reichstag into prison. That would be the equivalent of throwing most of the members of splinter political parties in our Congress into jail and barring the door for many of the others. They couldn't get in to make to the vote. And it gave him absolute power, is a little bit of an exaggeration. It took him half a decade to really to achieve that, but it gave him tremendous powers that he used very quickly to eliminate, for example, the opposition's majority in the cabinet, and to set up special courts to bypass the judicial system. The statistic in the second to the last paragraph, there were 268 political crimes in the docket, in court dockets in 1932, and in 1933, 11,000. It took him a long time to really infiltrate and take over the judicial system. It was a place, in fact, the Confessing Church was able to use the judicial system to overturn Nazi threats repeatedly all the way through the 30s. There were judges who wouldn't be bought or wouldn't be bent or wouldn't be cowed by the growing power of the Nazis. Well, actually, they were risking being threatened themselves by opposing, someone being in jail for some purpose. I actually don't even know how it turned out, but I don't think it was ultimately settled in Bonhoeffer's favor. But Bonhoeffer, for example, was told to cease and desist publishing, and he appealed it. He wrote several letters and claimed that his writings were theological, not political, and. In fact, it's really astonishing. The heroes of the movement from one end to the other would constantly say, you know, this is a church issue. This isn't a political issue, even Barman. It illustrates their efforts to try to retain some sphere of activity over against the Nazis. There are some great stories, as you probably know, the one of Bonhoeffer's mother. When there was a one-day boycott of the Jews and Jewish merchants and so forth, and a really quite small, unimposing woman marched through the SS, or actually they didn't exist yet, through the German police and soldiers and so forth that were there to kind of ensure the peace, quote unquote, and walked into the store and bought a basket of strawberries and marched back out. And lots of people remembered that as a really moving moment. And there were, of course, instances of that all over Germany. Regrettably and tragically, all too few instances of that. One of my favorite stories is of the church choir that quintupled its membership for a one-night sing outside a Gestapo prison in which their pastor was imprisoned. And church-going, nationalistic Germans found themselves in jail overnight and then questioned, and one of them in what I think is the best book on the subject, just astonishingly good book, For the Soul of the People, Protestant Protest Against Hitler. It's listed at the bottom of the page of the first handout, the full citation, published just a couple years ago by Oxford University Press. Tells the story of one of the person's recollections of that night, where all the doors were closed, they walked through hallways where there were locked doors in every place, she was describing the way in which this particular experience attempted to intimidate her and make her feel powerless, sitting in empty rooms with nothing on the walls and sort of the ugly color. If you've ever been in a jail in the United States, it's kind of ubiquitous, I guess, of construction of jails. Asking the same question over and over again and looking for loopholes and so forth. Well, she wasn't a part of any plot at all. I mean, she just went along to sing for her pastor. Or there's a marvelous story about the Nazis, in a kind of a heavy-handed way, breaking up a synod meeting that was getting too political, and they continued meeting in a house and decided they had to do something, and so they decided to have a rally. And they had no mimeograph machines or printing presses or anything. Radio was out of the question. By word of mouth, 30,000 people filled the square and the halls and so forth and protested this. And there was a mining town in sort of away from the bigger cities like Berlin. And there's story after story of these. And yet at the same time, for example, one of the tragic early parts that gave a hint of where things were going was and there's a whole chapter in Victoria Barnett's book of the treatment of the mentally disabled or mentally ill, disabled, etc. people who were, there were billboards saying that they were a drain on the economy and that it cost X much to support them and this is how much an average worker makes, and basically a we-them kind of mentality, much like we're finding today in the attacks on welfare and social spending. And there were people within the German Lutheran social service institutions that tried to fight that in various ways, and pastors who would give sermons on when they began to find out that these people were being killed. Tens of thousands of them. Vans would come up and people would be carted off, and people working in the institutions would work to try to reclassify as many people as possible to keep them from going. But it was much like the attempts to keep Jews, in the ghettos. I mean, it was a kind of a losing struggle. And again, the same kind of tragedy where lots of people would have protested a pastor in jail in a given region. There would be only a handful that would protest the killing of people from their congregation, and the difficulties of, rousing the public. And some of the highest leaders of the largest social service institutions like Bethel, really collaborating rather than protesting, feeling like it was better for them to retain some kind of communication. Feeling they had good relations with some people higher up, and they would say, "Well, it's really critical that I don't abuse those relationships because I need those to function for all the rest." And being torn between their pastoral duty and their leadership duty to the majority and their desire to do something about the minority that were being carted away. So it's in that context, and in fact that had just begun, it wasn't clear at all that people were being killed, to all but a tiny fraction of the people, when the equivalent of the church-wide assembly, a full-fledged synod meeting with representatives from most of the regional churches, met in Barmen in May of 1934, to, among other things, approve a statement that you have before you. It's just a two-page long piece. It's basically a series of comments on biblical texts. Six points. The principal author was Karl Barth, who had to leave Germany a few years later and was in Switzerland and elsewhere. and maybe just take a second to look through it, and in a minute, maybe one of you can read what, you know, sort of one of the typical statements that has political implications. You see, basically, each one of the six is a one or two Bible passages in the, after the number, 1 to 6. And then in bold, a positive statement, and then each one follows structurally with a sentence or two, we reject the false doctrine that. And it's typically there where the most pointed criticism is. But it's not the part in bold. I mean, just you can see by the structure of it, the folks that drafted this are attempting to say that this is a theological discussion, not a frontal attack on Hitler, which never would have passed. Barman, and this was approved with some significant majority. What's a kind of a, pick out a sentence that you feel captures some of the challenge to Hitler, or that captures a resistance to what Hitler was doing at this point. He'd been in power a year. Uh-huh. On several levels.
Yeah, for youth, both, but for one.
Okay, disbanding of the Luther Leagues and Walther Leagues, and having people only belong to the brown shirt, you know, the youth movements. They had one for girls and one for boys. What else was he asking for? There's a little bit of on the back of the Barman to Bonhoeffer sheet, the flashes here. German Christians really arose on their own. I mean, they weren't organized directly by Hitler or his closest people, but they were people that felt like this was the... Hitler had certainly told, you know, probably the 10,000 or so core supporters, the party leaders, we want to take over everything. We want to move into every arena of life. And people in the churches thought, well, that means, you know, let's side with the liberals, who have always wanted more of a kind of a central structure in church, and form all of the regional churches into a national Reich church. Well, so far that didn't cause a lot of upset, but what they had in mind really did. Because it meant both the bishop would not be solely accountable to the people and to the pastors, but would be accountable fundamentally to Hitler. So we've got the institutional structure, we've got the youth groups. What about the pastors? What were the pastors asked to do? How are they to be tied in allegiance, not just to the synodical structures, as we would put it, but to Hitler?
Well, at times we were actually given proclamations to bring forth from the pulpit.
Okay. Take a look at the Arian clauses, or Arian paragraph, about a third away from the bottom. It's in bold over on the right. 1933, September. Required that their pastors and their wives be free of Jewish blood. So no more people who were Lutherans, perhaps lifelong Lutherans, but who were of the wrong race, so-called. And ultimately, you may recall that pastors were asked, required, to sign a loyalty oath to the Führer, and to begin interjecting patriotic language into the various parts of the services, you know, that would affirm fealty to Hitler. Now, for those of us that had a kind of an image of the heroes of the church, and I'm thinking of people like Bonhoeffer or Niemöller. Quite a number of them signed those statements, and in fact, there was a kind of a tone or a feeling among Nazis or and among people on that end of the political spectrum that there was a special status accorded to people that had been early supporters of Hitler, that had been early Nazi party members. The Confessing Church repeatedly encouraged people not to give up their party membership. And in fact, many of them fought hard to retain it. And the idea was, that seems kind of astonishing that they wouldn't like quit in protest of what was happening, but they saw the writing on the wall that they would have much more power if they retained that connection, but to fight from the inside, as it were. I mean, knowing that you could accomplish little, but there were lots of advantages that would come. By the late 30s, nobody could travel without appropriate stamps on your passports, as it were. And one of the ways of having that capacity was to have been one of these early supporters of Hitler. And there were high-level people within the Confessing Church. I mean, I'm talking about leadership, formal leadership, who were these early supporters of Hitler. Niemöller, there's a whole story of his protests, of them, their attempts to throw him out of the church or to ask him to leave. And he said, no, you're going to have to throw me out, basically, because I have a right to join anything I want, you know. Just those kinds of stories, I think, are really illuminating for me and my naivete assumed that, you know, the good guys, the courageous people quit, you know, the Nazi party if they'd ever had any connection with it and went off and ran their own thing. But that's not how politics works. You need to be able to use whatever leverage you have within the ruling party, within the governing structures. And I feel personally frustrated with people that have only negative things to say about either Republicans or the current, you know, leadership in the Republican Party in Congress. I mean, it's just not either smart, nor is it, I think, particularly Christian to imply that, you know, that there's a choosing of sides. You know, of course, there's some terrible things that have been done by Democrats or Republicans. One could make a case that there are more bad things happening from the Republicans, I suppose. But the reality is that, you know, here we're talking about the earthly, the secular, the worldly arena, you know, the kingdom of the left hand and the kingdom of the right hand. And if we're serious about attempting to live out the call to be peacemakers, the call for justice, and in fact, the basic principle of loving anybody, even your enemies, it is not appropriate for us to behave in some of the ways that our instincts might lead us to behave, to have only criticism for folks. And I'm going to look it up in the next couple of days, but one of a really powerful experience when I've been beating my head against the wall for 2 weeks in Washington, D.C. on some legislation in the late 70s. On the last Sunday before I left, I was walking around in the mall in early morning and walked over to the Lincoln Memorial and for the first time read one of the statements cut in stone on the wall and came to the phrase where Lincoln was unwilling to judge the slaveholders and the leaders of the Confederacy and explicitly quoted, you know, God. God's the one that can do any judging. My task is to engage and to relate to and ultimately to re-embrace people that may have been on the other side. And it brought tears to my eyes. I mean, I felt so moved that if Lincoln could not find it himself to accept the idea of judging slaveholders and Confederate leaders, how much more, you know, should I be willing to retain the sense of humanity of those people that had been on the winning side of most of the bills that I'd been lobbying in for that year and in Washington those couple weeks. And it was a very humbling and sobering but useful moment. And liberating, ultimately. I mean, and that's, it seems to me that that's the power of the gospel, that we are freed to love our enemies or our political opponents, the people we think are doing terrible, terrible things. We need never turn them into the other. Those of you that saw Elie Wiesel, the video that was shown here the other day, where he repeatedly to Bill Moyer's questions would respond, you know, that he couldn't really hate the Nazis and the people in the camps. Real model for us Christians. So what, any other thoughts about Barman? Do you, about what it says, and maybe we can gradually move into what was its implications for us today? I mean, to what extent are some of these rejections of false doctrine relevant today?
It does seem to me that some people are talking about our being, still people are talking about our being the country that is specially blessed as chosen of God, and thus we will all think alike.
Reminds me of that wonderful line of the song, you know, the skies are blue, I love my country, but skies are blue in other lands, and the sun shines as bright on other people. And that call to embrace a kind of a global citizenship.
Yeah. I think the first statement on there is always important. We reject the false doctrine that the church could and should recognize as a source of proclamation beyond and besides this one word of God, yet other events, powers, historic figures as truths of God's revelation. There is a temptation sometimes to, you know, point to God's revelation some other place. And we get this thing, you know. I mean, we have almost a religion of ecology today, which sometimes almost supplants the Word of God. Not that ecology is wrong, but I mean, if it supplants the Word, it is.
So here's God, here's us. And the question is, are political authorities part of God's order toward us? Or are they independent? I'll put a P for political. Are they independent sources of authority for us? Would be one way of putting it. And the Barman Declaration decisively comes down on this side, that there are other authorities, but none of them is higher than or independent of God's authority, that our ultimate allegiance is to God. Everything else is transitory or contingent, right? Am I right? Is that what Barman is saying? And it's really kind of interesting to read the history of the reaction of the Nazis to this declaration over the months and years, because the church leaders repeatedly said, either with a straight face or more than that, believing totally that this had only, you know, relevance within the church. It was not an attempt to say something about Hitler. Well, fine and well, except what was Hitler striving for? Hitler was striving for H for Hitler. Hitler being the sole source of every other kind of authority, with the church and you know, political structures, etc., all being contingent, all being under his thumb. I mean, this, it not only was asking for independent status, but it was requiring, it was clear, the writing was on the wall to Barth and many other people, that Hitler was attempting to achieve this. This wasn't even acceptable. But this certainly wasn't. that total allegiance was totally contrary to Lutheran theology at its core, at its heart. And it was that apparent reality, just even a year after coming to power, that had disturbed so many Lutherans. And I should say this was another important piece about Barman, was that it brought together, really for the first time in that century at the very least, the Reformed, United, and Lutheran folks to together, you know, talk about their relationship to each other as well as the political order. Was there another question or comment? Yeah.
I'm just trying to make sense of how many German Christians were there.
It was never really very powerful, and ultimately Hitler thought they were just too bungling to be depended on, and he distanced himself from them and acted more directly, to deal with things. The Nazis really kind of bungled their relationship to the churches overall. They made a lot of really stupid efforts. There was a large meeting in the Berlin Sportsblast, for example, in which the speakers called for the removal of the Old Testament as part of the Bible because it was Jewish. Well, you can't be very bright and think that that isn't going to make it more difficult to consolidate your power vis-a-vis the church. And the astonishing thing is how many people went along with it, or at least didn't resist it. But that one was a very small minority. I mean, when you look at the theological education of the pastors in Germany, you just look at the institutional structure that the Nazis were entering into the turf of. That wasn't a very clever idea politically, let alone in other ways.
What about sort of the comparison to the Church of England? I mean, you have a not quite state religion, but you have a hierarchy,
right,
and you have
right.
a state.
Right.
And that's sort of more of a more benign situation than that's in the Reichskirche.
But that's a very important thing to raise, that the pastor's salaries really did flow through the state. There were collections, you know, passed around during the service. They went to the quasi-state authority and then back down through the hierarchy and the structure to the pastors. And just one illustration of what happened when you had whole groups of people graduating from Finkenwald, for example, the Confessing Church Seminary that Bonhoeffer led from 35 to 37, two full years. Those people had to pass exams of the official church, which was, had been taken over by the brown shirts. In fact, they called that synod, where that walkout occurred, with the Arian paragraph, the Brown Synod. Because of the ubiquity or the power of the German Christians, that is, those that supported Hitler. So you had these people graduating, and if they were not successful in being placed in a congregation and passing the exams in the official structure, there was no salary for them. So what happened in the confessing churches throughout Germany, there were two collections. There was one in the middle of the service, and then there was one at the back door. And in the stronger churches, you'd have four or five times as much money in the second collection than the first. And that collection went to pay the salaries of all of these pastors who would serve congregations but were not a part of the official structure. And I'm just going to try to see. I don't have my marked copy along with me. If I can spot the... there's a figure of how much money was raised that might help us just get a sense of the scale.
Did Hitler ever get control of that money? Or?
Not of that second part of money. I can't find it, but it was a really sizable amount of money that was being collected every month. And there were the predecessor to the... I'll just give a brief history of the Confessing Church, because I was totally wrong about some things on that, and it might be possible that you might benefit from a couple of the facts. The predecessor to it was a group called the Pastors Emergency League, PEL, which... would attempt to support pastors who were thrown into prison, to rally, to disseminate information about people that were in prison, and they would compile lists of pastors and others who were for people to pray for. So they used a theological or pastoral kind of a vehicle to also convey what I think is clearly political information. After Barman, you had the foundation for a kind of a resistance, particularly given Hitler's idea of how things ought to be. I mean, there was a collision course here. So while many churches that had delegates to that convention would ultimately align themselves in a kind of a neutral fashion, the majority actually had the grounds to be part of an alternative community, an alternative church, even though they were still within that structure that we talked about. And as well, there were churches that were ultimately on the outside that were whose pastors had to be paid, you know, entirely from contributions from those other churches that were still within the structure. The Barman document is most commonly called the Barman Declaration, but it's also termed the Barman Confession. And the reason I use that term up here was that was really the origin of the word confessing church. It really got its full-fledged structure and a board of directors and a kind of a parallel structure through that vehicle. For example, one of Bonhoeffer's most famous speeches was one he gave in 1934 to the International Youth Gathering. I can't remember the city offhand because it's the title that's often given to his comment, but he and other confessing church people couldn't become full delegates, and they all had to get there under other auspices. And he happened to have been, I think it was the chair of this international peace body that was connected with that, and that was the vehicle by which he even got to the assembly. The German Christians by then had taken over so much of the structure that they had kept the confessing church delegates from getting there. And he gave this really impassioned and wonderful talk about what had to happen. One of his more stirring speeches. I'll try to remember the title for those of you who are interested in tracking it down. So you basically had this underground church developing, but it had this really solid core within the institutional structure that allowed Barth, 10 years after the war, to say that in his view, the church managed to accomplish far more in their opposition to the Nazis than did all the other groups and institutions in German society, the universities, the legal profession, business, theater, art, the army, the trade unions. There are people that would quibble with that, but at the very minimum, there was a substantial structure there. And one of the really scary things about looking at the Nazi experience was, what would have happened if Hitler had been a little smarter? I mean, there were places where he could have bought off much larger sections of what ultimately ended in the Confessing Church, been not quite so arrogant and gross in the way in which he basically went against the grain of the Lutheran and Reformed and United traditions and pulled them in.
That's just what hit me when you said that thing about the Old Testament. I thought, goodness, if he hadn't done stuff like that, what would have happened?
Right.
Because that you would just think that
right.
Even proposing something like that would have been such a red flag that no one went to the church.
Right. I mean, the statistic that I listed in on this the second side of the fact sheet, I believe I put it in here, something to the effect that I guess I didn't. At one point before that Brown Synod that I referred to earlier in 1933, September, the Nazi party line was to encourage people to join the churches. and where 50,000 had left the church or had joined the church and 200,000 had left the church in 1932, those numbers were virtually reversed in 1933 in the early months. And it was partly a part of this strategy of taking over the church, that the Nazis would be willing to do that. But what would be the effect on, I mean, imagine your synod folks in a very similar situation to back there. I mean, declining revenues because of the economic problems in the world. Well, we don't have a state church, but the same effect has hit ELCA, you know, synods around the country. Now imagine what would happen if political leadership in the outside caused 200,000, 250,000 people to join the church and 50,000 to leave in one half year or 1 year period leading up to some important gatherings. Well, that and a whole lot of other things had really captured the imagination of a lot of well-meaning Christians, Lutherans. Lots of people saw Hitler as a hope. Those people that were anti-communists, and you know, the majority of Christians have been anti-communist right now. Well, the choice for a lot of people was it's either going to be the Bolsheviks or the Nazis. And Hitler was a political figure. In fact, really quite a savvy political figure. Not just ruthless, he was also savvy. I mean, he was doing what all politicians do, putting his finger up to the wind and trying to figure out what he could say that would get him into power. What, you know, the polls had a great deal of effect on his rhetoric. So there was something attractive to a lot of people. Niemöller was originally impressed by the Nazis. He had been a submarine captain in World War I, very patriotic, one of those early Nazis. But it didn't take him as long as a lot of people, most people, to figure out this was really not a totally positive thing. This was a real mixed bag, and then ultimately that Hitler was going to be a much greater threat than promise.
What point do you think fear took over and prevented people from doing?
Well, fairly early on, I mean, there were carrots and sticks. I mean, the police surrounding, you know, or being very evident during the boycott of Jewish businesses, and later in the late 30s, Kristallnacht, you know, mobilizing people against Jews. And just the stridency of the rhetoric. I mean, you read letters among the Bonhoeffers in the mid-30s, just how they would go to rallies and they would feel like they would be afraid that they were sticking out for not having the fervor of the people around them. But they found it very difficult to not show their distaste, their disgust for the kind of crudeness of the goings on. Well, you know, how do we feel when we happen on Rush Limbaugh on talk radio? You know, we're flipping the dial across and we get a station that's real loud and clear, and we listen for a minute and we go, ugh, you know. I'm reporting my own. I mean, he can be really pretty blunt at times. Right? Well, that kind of quality turned off a few people too. I mean, that was a hint that this wasn't just a wholly positive thing for Germany. Well, Barman did not get only positive reviews. There were many people that thought it was fighting on too narrow a front. Ted Gill, for example, is a big figure in the scholarly debates about this, said, "The confessing church was just too limited. It influenced some. They did not all stick. And altogether, did they do much? Yes, they put one fleeting, drowned fragrance in the otherwise universal stench. They were a winsome bunch, a winsome, crumbling bunch." Elsewhere, he called it too little, too late. Kind of a sobering kind of a thing. Barth himself was quoted in a letter to Bethke after the war. I have a few couple copies of this if anybody's interested in some of this. Quote, "It was new to me that Bonhoeffer, as I read your biography of him, in 1933 viewed the Jewish problem as the first and decisive question, even as the only one, and took it in hand so energetically. I myself have long felt guilty that I did not make this problem central, at least public, in the two Barman Declarations of 1934, one of which we've looked at here, which I had composed. In 1934, certainly, a text in which I had said a word to that effect would not have found agreement either in the Reform Synod of January or in the General Synod of May at Barman, if one considers the state of mind of the confessors of faith in those days. But that I was caught up in my own affairs somewhere else is no excuse for my not having properly fought for this cause. It was really, regrettably and tragically, part of the rhetoric of the day that the Jews were part of the problem. They were like less than fully, you know, human. They were, you know, had killed Christ. They were somehow worse than, well, I remember my Missouri Synod Lutheran roots where the Catholics were somehow worse than some other folks because of the papacy and what they did to Luther. I mean, when we read the story of Luther, the Catholics came out pretty badly. Well, you know, they had some serious abuses, true, but there was nothing that really helped you bring Catholic Church back into at least, you know, the churches for which, you know, that were preaching the gospel. They were left pretty far out on the fringe by our rhetoric, and it's a kind of a feeble attempt to find a parallel with Barman. Well, let's take a look also at Bonhoeffer. We've already seen his very early understanding of what was wrong, his speaking out about the Jews in 1933 when Hitler was just coming to power. He had a radio address before Hitler even assumed office in which he criticized Hitler. His prescience was really astonishing. He'd been in New York City in 1930. He had been in Spain for his kind of internship and saw poverty there and had traveled in the early 30s and late 20s in ecumenical kinds of gatherings. So he was he had more of an understanding of the place of the German church and the strengths and weaknesses of his tradition than most people. He passed his exams and became a professor in Berlin in 1933, I believe it was. He was 24, so I guess it would be even before then. It would be when he came back from New York, 1930. That was when he became a professor of theology in Berlin. An incredible figure in terms of how early his you know learning came. I mean, he died at the age of 39, and his doctoral thesis was called by Barth a theological miracle, and it centered on one of the two main themes of his life: the church and ethics. It was on really the communion of saints, he saw it. His definition of the church was the church in the world, and so it was. It's no surprise that he would be moved into ethics just theologically, as well as because of his travels and his contact with the poor. He came from an upper class or upper middle class family. And then to be a part of a faculty in a confessing church in the mid-30s, 35 to 37, a seminary rather, and to struggle with people, should they register for the military? You know, very much the questions that we deal with. And the, you know, majority opinion, even the people that were closest to Bonhoeffer personally, feeling patriotic, feeling like if they went to war, they should go also, and Bonhoeffer, the pacifist, wrestling with that authentic, patriotic spirit, as well as, you know, the degrees to which people had been corrupted by Nazi rhetoric. And then the involvement of Hitler in the efforts to overthrow Hitler. And it's, to be fair, assassination was never the only possibility. Bonhoeffer's role for himself was to use his ecumenical ties and his ability to travel and a passport that he got from his friends' friends or his family's friends that was virtually the passport that was the passport they gave to spies. So at the one hand, one arm of the Nazi regime is ultimately telling him that he can't publish anymore or speak, and the other hand had given him this passport that allowed him to travel freely around the world, attempting to line up Allied support for an alternative to Hitler. Spent some of his time in a monastery in Italy there. So engaged with the poor in Spain, went his first teaching post in Berlin in 1930. He served a congregation in the poorest area and ultimately learned a lot from the experience of working with these working class kids. Really allowed him to have a kind of a perspective on reality that was rare in his time. And there, you've undoubtedly heard the wonderful quote from the Letters and Papers from Prison. I'll share it. "There remains an experience of incomparable value to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcast, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed, the reviled. In short, from the perspective of those who suffer, to look with new eyes on matters great and small." A quote that meant a great deal to Gutierrez, Sobrino, and many of the other pioneers of the liberation theology movements in Latin America. Bonhoeffer was a really important influence. And this quote, particularly germinal and powerful moment. Or, "Christianity stands or falls with its revolutionary protest against violence, arbitrariness, and pride of power." Barman. Happens that Bonhoeffer was out of the country during Barman, but had more than a little influence on its origin. "Christendom adjusts itself far too easily to the worship of power. Christians should give more offense, shock the world far more than they are doing now. Christians should take a stronger stand in favor of the weak rather than consider the possible right of the strong." Defense of the, you know, mentally incapacitated and sick. Terminally ill were among those that were loaded into buses and shipped off to be killed. What would qualify as do anything? And I'll answer that.
They were kind of heavily locked in. And they could only attack Hitler kind of tangentially. I mean, they couldn't say he was a jerk.
They did. There were people that did.
Okay. But did they able to help people escape money?
Yes, it became... I mean, it was one of the few networks, and there were others. I mean, jurists, for example, would know each other, had met each other at their conventions, would continue to meet them, and became a kind of a network for people within the judicial structure that wanted to basically allow people to get out. For example, there was a whole network of pastors who took on the task of helping Jews get out of the country. 50 or 60 pastors was one network. On a whole lot of different levels, support for people thrown into prison and a communications network to help it be heard, attacking efforts of the Nazis to put down Jews and others and to ultimately cart them off, really quite a range of ways, raising funds for various kinds of activities.
It just triggered something. I wondered, did that German Lutheran structure, the Confessing Church, kind of link with some of the Lutheran churches in other countries?
Yes.
Because there was, my father once traveled in Europe with a Swedish Lutheran pastor who had apparently been involved in getting some Jews out of Germany. I wondered if that happens through church links.
Yeah, again, the Nazis had their eyes and ears open, and they gradually clamped down on that kind of activity, and until it, the only people that could do it easily were people within the Brown Synod, you know, the Nazi-aligned structure. But the official structure of the Confessing Church lasted for a long time, and it varied from one place to another. I mean, the top of page 2, the German Christians, and then the discussion about, oh, I'm sorry, the bottom of the paragraph right above the subhead, militarism and war, the intact churches being one whole kind of attempt to respond to Hitler, and then the old Prussian Union another, just because of their real different situations and some real tension between the two. I mean, there's an amazing story of a meeting between the bishops of the three intact churches and Niemöller and Hitler, and they thought if they could just present their case. Does that have an echo? Have you ever heard that? If we could just present our case to some authority figure, they would see the light and they would go our way. Well, Hitler had Himmler in the meeting unexpectedly, who opened the meeting by reading from wiretaps on Niemöller's phone. And the three bishops, instead of reacting in horror that Hitler would intrude into their legitimate terrain like this by tapping the phone, were successfully, by this maneuver,